The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says Israel's continued aggressions against the Al-Aqsa Mosque will cause an explosion in the region. Iran's foreign ministry summons Greece's charge d'affaires in protest at the seizure of an Iranian-flagged ship and its cargo in Greek waters. Also ahead, Iran blames the U.S.'s failure to make political decisions for stalled talks on the revival of the 2015 deal as Washington threatens to step up sanctions. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement hails the victory over Israel in 2000, saying it was an unprecedented achievement for the resistance. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was delivering an address marking the 22nd anniversary of the liberation of southern Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. He said the victory thwarted the regime's project for creating a greater Israel. The Hezbollah leader said Israel is a barbaric entity that only pretends to be civilized. Nasrallah said Hezbollah has been fighting to protect Lebanon and its people without having any intention to grab power. The Hezbollah leader added that the resistance movement does not seek permission from anyone to protect the country. He also warned Israel about continuation of its aggressions against Al-Aqsa Mosque. Nasrallah said any aggression against Al-Aqsa and other sanctities of Muslims will cause an explosion in the region. Lebanon marks the Resistance and Liberation Day on May 25th every year. Hezbollah forces drove Israel out of southern Lebanon in May 2000, ending over two decades of the regime's occupation. Iran's foreign ministry has summoned Greece's charge d'affaires to convey Tehran's strong protest to Athens over the seizure of an Iranian-flagged ship and its cargo. An Iranian foreign ministry official said Greece seized the ship under illegal pressure from the United States. He said the vessel had stopped in Greek waters due to a technical glitch and its seizure was against Athens' international obligations. The official said the seizure of the ship's cargo amounted to international piracy, holding the Greek government and those who illegally seized the cargo responsible. He said the Iranian government will not overlook its legal rights in this case and expects the Greek government to abide by its international obligations. Greece is holding the Iranian-flagged vessel in its waters. Its cargo has been seized in coordination with the U.S. government. Talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal remain stalled over what Tehran calls Washington's failure to make political decisions. Now, the U.S. has threatened to tighten sanctions on Iran if the deal is not restored. U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, issued the threat during a congressional testimony. He said the prospects of reviving the accord are at best tenuous. He said the White House will continue to reject what it considers unreasonable demands from Iran. Meanwhile, the U.S. Treasury Department announced fresh sanctions on some individuals and entities for being linked to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The department claimed the IRGC leads an international oil smuggling and money laundering network. Iran has reiterated that the JCPOA revival hinges on the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington will not exit the deal again, as it did in 2018. Turkey has threatened to block NATO's accession process of Sweden and Finland unless they address Ankara's security concerns.
Türkiye'nin güvenlik kaygıları.
We conveyed our message in very clear terms that the process will not move forward unless Turkey's security concerns are addressed through concrete steps and within a certain timetable.
The comment was made by Turkey's presidential spokesman following a meeting with Swedish and Finnish representatives in the Turkish capital. Ibrahim Kalin said the Nordic states told Turkey they understand its security concerns, adding that dialogue will continue. Stockholm and Helsinki launched their NATO accession bids last week. Support for their membership has soared following the war in Ukraine. Turkey has opposed their membership over what it calls leniency towards Kurdish, that is, militant groups it considers terrorist outfits. Any NATO membership must be unanimously approved by all members. Ukraine's foreign minister accuses NATO of, quote, doing literally nothing in the face of Russia's military operation, while praising the European Union's backing for Kiev. Dmytro Kuleba said NATO is completely sidelined and does nothing to help Ukraine in its war with Russia. Kuleba, however, praised the EU for taking what he called revolutionary and groundbreaking decisions against Russia. Ukraine has been complaining over NATO's indecisive position on Kiev's accession to the military alliance. Russia strongly opposes Ukraine's membership in NATO. The EU has imposed a barrage of sanctions against Moscow since the war in Ukraine started. EU member states are now mulling an oil embargo against Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky dismisses suggestions that his country should give up territory and make concessions to end the war with Russia. Zelensky made the angry remarks in a video address to the World Economic Forum in Davos. He was reacting to a suggestion by former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger that Ukraine should let Russia keep Crimea, which it annexed in 2014. The New York Times editorial board also said last week that Ukraine might have to make, quote, hard decisions to pave the way for a negotiated peace. Zelensky dismissed both suggestions, saying negotiations for a peace deal cannot resume until Russia withdraws its troops. Zelensky has said that he would only discuss an end to hostilities with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and not via intermediaries. The British Prime Minister has been under fire for months over parties held in breach of COVID lockdown rules. After repeated denial and apology by Boris Johnson, an official report now blames him and his government for the Partygate culture. We discussed the issue earlier in our news review programme.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. The British Prime Minister is in hot water again over COVID lockdown breaking parties. Long-awaited official report blames Boris Johnson and his government for the Partygate culture. The report by Sue Gray, a senior civil servant, says the leadership and top officials must bear responsibility for violating COVID rules. The report probed 16 such events held at Whitehall and Downing Street, while the country was placed under strict lockdown in 2020 at the height of the pandemic. Moments after the report was published, Johnson, addressing Parliament, said he takes full responsibility for what had happened.
And I want to begin today by renewing my apology to the House, to the whole country, for the short lunchtime gathering on the 19th of June 2020 in the Cabinet Room, during which I stood at my place at the Cabinet table and for which I received a fixed penalty notice. And I also want to say, Mr. Speaker, above all, that I take full responsibility for everything that took place on my watch.
The Premier also said that he was humbled and learned his lesson, but he insisted he was surprised and disappointed over drink-fueled events. That is while new revelations show Johnson himself attended a booze-filled party at his office, adding to the calls for him to resign. The opposition Labour Party leader has lashed out at the Prime Minister. Keir Starmer says the report would stand as a monument to the, quote, hubris and arrogance of Johnson's government. He censured the government for flouting the COVID lockdown rules. Rob Carter is a correspondent joining us from London to give us the latest, and we also have Len Bidopic, former UK Member of Parliament, joining us from London also. Welcome to you both, Rob Carter. So, we've seen what the report's findings are, and we've seen the way Boris Johnson has reacted. Tell us about, or give us some highlights of that, and if you've had any chance to get some people's reactions on this.
Sure. Well, basically, Boris Johnson is in a very awkward position. There's no doubt about it. It's just the drip, drip of these endless scandals really seem to be taking their toll now. Real pressure on the Prime Minister to basically resign as a result of these numerous parties, boozy parties that were conducted in Number 10, one of which, of course, was a birthday celebration. I think it was in June 2020. And this was a time when, obviously, the government was enforcing laws where the rest of us couldn't meet our friends and families, let alone do many other things. But of course, it seems as if it is very true that it's one rule for the rest of us and another totally for this government. It's a very, very difficult position that the Prime Minister finds himself in. And basically, after the recent presser that just ended just moments ago, where the Prime Minister took I think it was just a number of questions, maybe about 9 questions or so. Basically, he was refusing to... the point he was trying to make was that, look, he's apologised to the House and to the public, but ultimately he thinks that he could just be allowed to move on. And that's something which he hopes very much so will happen. But obviously his critics and the opposition are going to keep the spotlight on him and are going to pressure him, if not to resign, then to take some real meaningful measures to maybe hold some of his colleagues to account who were in attendance at those parties and some of which actually organized the boozy event.
Len Bidopic, so what do you think should be done in this case? The point, I mean, obviously he says this has all happened under my watch, so I'm the one responsible. But I don't believe, at least your opinion matters here, that suffice. So how should Boris Johnson, you think, proceed?
First of all, the dog in the street knows that he knew there were parties. Let's not pretend. He can sue me if he wants to on that one, and let's see how far he gets. Secondly, there's massive resentment from millions of people around the country, including potentially me, because my mother died last July, and I only saw her at the end of her life. I didn't get to see her physically for a year and a half because of the very lockdown rules that Boris Johnson and his colleagues seem to have broken. I would say specifically, number one, there's still an inquiry to happen in Parliament, and it would be astounding if they accepted this, in my view, lame belief that Boris Johnson could stand with a glass in his hand, surrounded by bottles and people, and didn't realize it was a party. The second thing is, If people feel like it, they could go and they could appeal against the crimes that they've been accused of on the basis that if they broke lockdown, they can say, well, the Prime Minister did worse, and he looks like he did it more than once. So why should we have this on our records whenever it turns out that the Prime Minister had done much more than that and got away with it?
Very well. Let's listen to some of the online posts on this, reacted to the story. We'll get right back to the conversation. First post, something that is highlighted by Partygate and the Sue Gray report is that our Constitution has no safeguards against the Prime Minister devoid of morality. It's built on an assumption of decency and integrity, which the current government has torn apart. Next post, I knew when Johnson became Prime Minister we were in for trouble, but even people like me are astounded at how bad it's been, not just Partygate, but his whole time as Prime Minister. I think so many people are fed up with Partygate, which would stop if our PM did the honorable and decent thing. He has lied, he has been caught lying, tried to blame everyone but himself, and is turning his government into a circus. He has the power to end this, but he won't. And the final post, another day to be embarrassed by being British. I don't know how Boris Johnson can try and defend himself. After the Partygate scandal, the Sue Gray report has really shown that the Tory government, what the Tory government is really about, themselves. Time for change. All right, so those were some of the online posts. Rob Carter, sifting through some of the lines that Boris Johnson fed the public, whether it's in Parliament, not the public, but at Parliament and then in the presser, do you get the feeling that there may be somebody that's going to take the fall for him, or somehow for him to be relieved of that guilty verdict that he's obviously so appropriately given to him?
But one thing I want to make, one point I want to mention to our audience is that there is a real problem here, because not only is Boris Johnson's government heavily criticized and being condemned for all of these outrageous photos that are being leaked now, but actually the opposition on the other side of the House also has its own problems in this regard. So Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition, he also is being investigated for photos that were leaked of him, of himself also apparently attending parties which he shouldn't have been doing during the lockdown, where there, again, there were boos present. So we have a kind of institutional issue here, which seems to show that the whole of Westminster is facing a crisis of corruption, where they just seem to be treating themselves differently to everyone else. It's one rule for us and another for them. So it's very difficult when you have an opposition trying to pressure the government on this issue, when actually members of the opposition have also been potentially guilty of the same crimes.
Very well, thank you for that. We appreciate it. Lempit Opik there, former UK Member of Parliament. And Rob Carter, thank you, correspondent from London. And with that, we come to an end for this news review.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Advocates for independently owned businesses warn that restaurants, gyms, and other main street businesses across the U.S. will be forced to close in the coming month after Republicans in the Senate recently blocked a $48 billion package to provide relief to owners who have struggled to stay afloat during the coronavirus pandemic. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Nearly 90,000 Small Businesses in U.S. Expected to Close After Senate GOP Kills Main Street Relief Bill. Here's the story. Advocates for independently owned businesses warn that restaurants, gyms, and other main street businesses across the U.S. will be forced to close in the coming months after Republicans in the Senate recently blocked a $48 billion package to provide relief to owners who have struggled to stay afloat during the coronavirus pandemic. The Bipartisan Small Business COVID Relief Act, which was meant to replenish the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, RRF, passed last year was co-sponsored by Senator Roger Wicker, but it still failed to get more than 5 Republican senators to support it. The vast majority of GOP lawmakers claim that helping locally owned restaurants to stay open and continue employing people in their communities would worsen inflation and contribute to the deficit, with Senator Ron Paul saying on the Senate floor that dumping more money in the economy is simply pouring $5 a gallon gas on an already out-of-control fire. As a result, said Erika Polmar of the Independent Restaurant Coalition, we estimate more than half of the 177,300 restaurants waiting for an RRF grant will close in the next few months. The bill would have given $40 billion to the independent restaurants left out of the restaurant relief program, which passed last year but ran out of funds in just 3 weeks, with only 1 in 3 applicants receiving grants. Polmar said local restaurants across the U.S. expected help, but the Senate couldn't finish the job. Neighborhood restaurants nationwide have held out hope for this program, selling their homes, cashing out retirement funds, or taking personal loans in an effort to keep their employees working. The RRF bill would also have given $2 billion for gyms and fitness centers, $2 billion for live event companies, $2 billion for bus and ferry operators, $1.4 billion for companies near border crossings, which have shut down during the pandemic, and $500 million for minor league sports teams. The Community Gyms Coalition told The Hill that although an RRF replenishment bill passed in the House, the Senate failed to invest in fitness and exercise, despite their obvious benefits for Americans' mental and physical health. After hanging on for another year, hurting restaurants throughout the United States, especially in rural communities, may not see any relief despite the House passing a bill just last month to put more money into the RRF, said Didier Trin, Policy and Political Impact Director for Main Street Alliance, MSA. The fate of these small businesses, including ones owned by women and people of color that were left behind, will be tied to those senators who voted down this lifeline today. Along with Wicker, Senators Lisa Murkowski, Ronnie Blunt, Susan Collins, and Bill Cassidy were the only Republicans who joined Democrats in voting for the bill. The Democrats needed at least 10 Republicans to support the legislation to reach 60 votes required by the legislative filibuster. MSA tweeted, senators who ensured this fate instead of providing the relief small business needs now must be held accountable. Tyler Akin, a board member of the IRC and a chef in Wellington, Delaware, noted that the GOP's rejection of the bill immediately followed a vote approving $40 billion of military and humanitarian aid for Ukraine, more than $7 billion than President Joe Biden had requested. Ironically, this filibuster followed a vote to stand in solidarity at a similar level of funding with a group of European allies that handled some of the worst effects of the past 2 years with far more grace and unity, Akin told the Philadelphia Inquirer, adding, "It's clear that those who aligned with Senator Pat Toomey today have little or no desire to support small businesses."
Food for thought.
Salam. And we start the day by contemplating upon a valuable piece of advice from the Prophet's infallible successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him. Three characteristics bring about hatred, that is, hypocrisy, oppression, and self-conceit.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyarah of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: إذا كانت لك حاجة إلى الله فقل: اللهم إني أسألك بحق محمد وعلي، فإن لهما عندك شأنا من الشأن.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, if you have a need from Allah, then say, O Allah, verily I ask you for the sake of Muhammad and Ali, for verily they have a special station with you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You are listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, in the beautiful conversations of the divinely appointed imams, and in this case, the divinely appointed imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that Imam al-Kadhim really, in this dialogue, he speaks about something that is very interesting. He speaks about the disobedience that a human being commits against Allah, meaning how sometimes, unfortunately, may Allah forgive and may Allah forbid, a human being disobeys the Almighty Allah. Now, of course, I'm sure that many of you have heard about the conversations and the dialogues, especially on this program, from all of the divinely appointed imams. But here there is a conversation that the divinely appointed imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the immaculate imam, has with his son. In this beautiful conversation between father and son, we find that Imam al-Kadhim says, O my little son, beware that Allah sees you commit an act of disobedience from which he has prohibited you. Allahu Akbar. So much time of our life is spent, first and foremost, in the disobedience of Allah. But second, and what makes it worst, is the fact that we don't even consider that we are disobeying Allah in these large parts of our life. Meaning not only are we committing sin and not only are we committing disobedience against the Almighty Allah, but at the same time, we are negligent of it. We don't even think about it. We don't even realize it. And so here we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam speaks to his son and he says, be very careful that the Almighty Allah not see you committing an act that he has prohibited you. So first and foremost, brothers and sisters, we must know what Allah has prohibited us from. And then we must not do that. And a third very interesting point that comes up here is that we should realize that Allah is seeing us at all times. In some of the definitions of taqwa, piety as is commonly known, this definition is put forth. this awareness that Allah is present, this awareness that Allah sees and hears everything. And so as Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam has said, we must all be very careful that Allah may not see us committing an action that Allah has considered disobedience and that which Allah has prohibited us from. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Tawriya means to make a statement where those who are supposed to get the message in the right way, where the enemies would be misled by that same statement. You know, this is, and if you look at that wasiyyah that Imam wrote, Mansur actually sent a message to his governor in Medina, and he said, find out, where is his wasiyyah? Whom has he appointed as his wasi? And whoever's name you find there, kill him and send his head to me. So Muhammad bin Sulaiman, who was the governor of Medina, went and inquired about it. And then he wrote to Mansur. He said, the order that you have given to me is impossible to be implemented. Why? He said, I saw the wasiyyah of the sixth imam, and he has named five individuals. The first name is yours, Mansur. The second name is Muhammad bin Sulaiman, the governor of Medina. So I can't implement this order. The third name is of Hamida, the wife of the sixth imam. We know that she cannot be imam or khalifa or nabi or rasul anyway. The fourth name is Abdullah, the older surviving son of sixth imam. And the fifth name is of Musa al-Kazim, the younger son of the sixth imam. Now, if you look at this, Imam has already confused the enemies. So they don't know who. And with Mansur's name there, he cannot go and say, kill whomever you find mentioned in this wasiyyah. But the Shias knew that the name of Mansur and Muhammad bin Sulaiman is there just to, you know, misguide the enemies, confuse the enemy. Hamida Khatun, she is a very respected lady in the Shia community, but she cannot be the imam. So you eliminate her name also. Then you are left with two names, Abdullah and Musa. The Shias know Abdullah is older one, Musa is younger one. If the older one was worthy of becoming the imam, imam would not have mentioned the younger one. And so you eliminate the name of Abdullah also, and that's where you get the indication that the waris and the naib and the successor of the sixth imam is none other than Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam. So brothers and sisters, this deen and mazhab has not come to us that easily. Cherish this. Value this. There is sacrifices that which has gone in every generation before this deen and mazhab came to us. It was not that easy for, you know, this deen to survive.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
يا بدر المدينة خير خلق الله يا
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With the light.
The meadows in the foothills of the Swiss Alps have turned white these days, with locals calling it May snow. But it has nothing to do with snow. It's all about narcissus blooms covering the hills above the town of Montreux. Locals call the scene May snow because it looks like a blanket of snow from a distance. The flowers have been a tourist attraction since the 19th century, but factors such as urbanization have caused their decline in the past few years. Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural, hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Haptonbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a white flower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate. A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in Southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide
It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, 5 deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past 6 decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from the hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment, and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryant said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make 5 blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A vocal minority in the U.S. are demanding not gun bans, but book bans, trying to suppress the teaching of the U.S. deep-seated systematic racism. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan, writers. This article is published under the heading The Buffalo Massacre, Banning Books, and Systematic Racism. Stay tuned for more. Ten people were slaughtered in Buffalo recently, killed at a supermarket in the heart of the black community. The gunman, an 18-year-old self-professed white supremacist armed with a legally purchased Bushmaster AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle. His goal, based on rambling, poisonous 180-page document he posted online, was to kill as many blacks as possible. Of the 13 victims, including three who were injured, 11 were African-American. The killer live-streamed the massacre on the social media video website Twitch. While the Amazon-owned site pulled down the gruesome video within minutes, it was immediately posted, then accessed by millions on other internet platforms. Challenging racist violence demands an understanding of U.S. true history. Instead, a vocal minority in the U.S. are demanding not gun bans, but book bans, trying to suppress the teaching of U.S. deep-seated systematic racism. The Buffalo shooter espoused a conspiracy theory known as the Great Replacement, which wrongly posits that traditional native-born white majorities are being replaced by people of color, immigrants, and Muslims, aided and abetted by a left-wing globalist elite. This new population, the racist replacement theory maintains, compliantly votes according to the dictates of their supposed Democratic Party sponsors. The killer, who is in custody, directed his animus at replacers, as he called them, principally African Americans. His slapdash screed, which borrows heavily from another one posted by the racist mass murderer who perpetrated the Christchurch, New Zealand mosque massacres in 2019, betrays a profound ignorance of the history and racism in the United States of America. Abram X. Kendi, founding director of Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research, warned on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, this crisis of white supremacist domestic terror is likely to get worse.